Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, peacemaking in a Palestinian village, the Liverpool-Nablus connection, and shining the spotlight on the figure of Saint Benedict and his rule. Well, let's begin by joining Philippa Hitchin in the Holy Land, where she's been travelling over the past week with the so-called Holy Land Coordination Group. That's to say bishops from across Europe and North America who make an annual pilgrimage to this part of the world in support of the Christian communities. While there, Philippa met with Pax Christi Executive Committee member Anne Farr, now on her ecumenical accompaniment placement in the village of Yanun, not far from Nablus.
Pax Christi organisation is marking Peace Sunday, isn't it, this coming Sunday?
Yes, we are. It's a very important day in our calendar. Our work is based on Pope's message for Peace Sunday. And there are materials that people can use which will reflect on that message and that people can use in their own communities, in their churches and with children.
So reflecting the theme of religious freedom as a key to peace this year?
Yes, it is. And this is very important for us that are working at the moment out in Palestine and Israel because, of course, the tolerance between peoples and between religions is just so important. So this is a very vital Sunday for us.
What do you ask people in parishes around the country to do?
We ask them to think about peace and ways in which they can be peacemakers in a very practical way. Not everybody can come out to Palestine or to other areas of conflict, but everybody can be a peacemaker in their own community, at home, in their neighbourhood, in school, and so on. So everybody can choose something that they can do to make peace possible.
You work also as an ecumenical accompanier, don't you? This is a programme of the World Council of Churches, I believe. Tell us a bit more about it.
Well, to be an ecumenical accompanier means we're part of a group of people that come out to be a protection through presence. The whole idea is that we're a non-violent way of being in an area of conflict, and in this case in the West Bank, and there are six places in which we do our work. All of them have different problems. The World Council of Churches supports it, as do other charities and other organisations like Pax Christi and CAFOD. And all the time we're alongside the people. And we work with both Palestinian and Israeli peacemakers.
You're talking about different problems in the different areas, the different villages. Mm. Just give us an idea of the kind of things you're looking at.
Well, in areas like Bethlehem and Jerusalem and Hebron, they're very much faced with the issues of the wall and checkpoints, which are causing lack of freedom and denial of human rights to the people of Palestine. And also, of course, Palestinians and Israelis cannot cross over to the opposite side of the wall. In the area that I'm in, our principal problem is the illegal settlements. I'm up near Nablus and based in a tiny village called Yanun, which at the time of the Intifada and afterwards, the villagers were removed, forcibly removed from their village at gunpoint by illegal Israeli settlers. They left the village and they've only returned because of the presence of the beginning Israeli peacemakers and now our international presence. So four of us are there and we are our permanent presence.
What difference do you make, do you think?
Well, sometimes it's very hard to see, you know, that you're making a presence sitting or being, working, getting to know the villagers in this tiny, tiny little beautiful village. But they tell us that they only remain there because of our presence. If we weren't there, they wouldn't be there either. And we become very aware that they're living in fear all the time. In our village, we can see all the way around us on the tops of the hills the outposts of the Israeli settlement of Itamar, for example. And at other times of the year, settlers will come down and will cause harassment. In the past, they've bathed and urinated and let their animals go into the well, so polluting the drinking water. The well's now being covered in, so that's not possible, but there's a whole history of harassment there. We just hope that by being there, the villagers will feel safer, but also we go out to other villages and into the Jordan Valley.
It looked as though putting a freeze on these settlements, perhaps trying to get rid of the illegal ones, was on the agenda. Now it seems to have slipped off again. It must be very depressing in a way in this work.
It is very depressing, and in the villages that we go out to, we often get calls, and we're in touch all the time with certain villages for which we have some responsibility for observation. And in the last 2 weeks, for example, we've been called out to situations where a lot of their land has been stolen by the settlers, so they don't have access to grow things, and they don't have access to graze their animals. On the land that they've got left, for example, we saw fields that had been burnt by settlers who had come down from their homes and their outposts at the tops of the hills. Also, small sapling trees had been uprooted in their hundreds. Trees have been damaged with knives so that they will take many years to recover, if they recover at all. And also, I've seen several examples of spring water, the source of the water for the village, just having been totally destroyed. So that the very existence, the livelihood of the people is threatened. And very, very poor people, as they all are, don't have the income from their olives, don't have the feed for their animals, and they have to buy water at great expense. And when I asked the secretary of many municipalities, what happens to these people who have no money, he said they don't have water. Each family has to buy their own, and if they have no money, they have no water. So these are the sorts of situations that we see. So the problem of the theft of land, the control and also denial of water, and the destruction of the olive trees is something that we see all the time.
You're reporting all this back, aren't you, to international organisations, the UN, human rights groups. Yes. What happens to it then?
Well, they try to follow it up, but they've got a huge list of things that they've got to follow up. So, for example, one thing that we followed 2 weeks ago, we went out to a little tiny shack set of dwellings in the Jordan Valley. Just maybe 4 feet away from these homes were the greenhouses of the settlements who have taken their land. And the IDF came out in 4 vehicles, so 16 soldiers and security vehicles as well with their personnel, to tell the villagers that they had to remove the piece of plastic that they had put over their tent dwelling. The tent was already made of the sacks of the animal feed sewn together, and they had put this polythene over the top of it. The soldiers made them take this polythene off and spent ages doing it, and then stood guard the whole day to make sure they didn't put it back on. But it was all right for them to put the polythene over the animals. Now, those sorts of things and other demolition examples that we have seen, we report to the various organisations, and there is actually very little that they can do, but it does go into the accumulative report of these agencies like the United Nations and the World Council of Churches. There is pressure being put on all the time, and questions will be asked. But again, sometimes you feel that these little groups of people who are so powerless are at the bottom of the pile, and you feel really that, on the whole, nobody is caring for them. They're just one of many groups of people. They say they go in the reports, but what practical action can take place against a big powerful nation like Israel, the Israeli government, who is supporting the settlement work? Sometimes it's very hard to see this happen, and then thinking, but we must report it. We report it to Human Rights Watch, and we hope that international groups will then ask questions of the right people. It's up to people overseas. It's the international community, the various governments and the European governments and America, for the people, the grassroots people, to ask questions and demand that action is taken on behalf of these people who have no power for themselves.
Where do you see the solution coming from in this region? It seems, again, to have slipped off the political agenda. There seems to be very little interest in really pushing the two sides closer to a lasting peace settlement.
That's an enormous question. People ask this at home all the time. Various people put forward different political solutions. There are several different versions of the one-state solution, also different versions of the two-state solution. I can see that the people of Palestine and the Israeli peacemakers, many have a feeling of hopelessness. And unlike when I came back from South Africa many years ago, it's almost impossible to see what the solution is, because we know that if there's a stand taken by the Israeli government about settlements, doubtless the government will be brought down because it's such a huge thing. Unless people it sounds almost like a cliche, but unless people see each other, meet each other, begin to see that the other is not the enemy, and in a way it's the small projects that make the difference. At the top levels, I can't see any movement unless there's something going on behind the scenes. But my hope is in the small groups of people who are working together, like the Pax Christi Partnership in Bethlehem, where they work with Christians and Muslims in that area to build bridges, to develop communities, like the schools where they're few, but the schools where the Jewish and the Palestinian children go to work together, go to school together. And it's those... my hope is in those small grassroots communities and also those at home and in the international community that will do the same. On a large-scale political scale at the moment, I'm afraid I don't see a solution.
Pax Christi is, of course, a Catholic, international Catholic network. Mm-hmm. What can other Catholics, other Christians do to support people here?
Well, one of the things they can do is to support the work that is being done by Christian organisations. Pax Christi has a ministry to the Middle East, and particularly to Palestine and Israel, by praying, by providing financially, but also by working with those that are peacemakers. But by focusing our prayer, as it is this year, on Jerusalem and the Christians here, we can look to the work that we're doing out here, that many people are doing, work with both Christians and Muslims, that our prayer will lead us to a greater awareness, that we will know what people like Pax Christi and CAFOD and EAPPI and other organisations are doing, and that by being in solidarity, we will then want to make changes, and that we will use whatever political power we have with our governments, with the European Parliament and with the various embassies, that we will then ask questions and ask for the human rights of people to be honoured, and that those who are the poorest and the weakest and the marginalised will, as Jesus asked us to do, will be those that we focus on, and that we will try to make a difference for them, and that they will know that we are in solidarity with them, and that we're not just... that our prayers are not just idle, that we actually do what Jesus asked us to do, and that is to be peacemakers and to work for justice, because that is the heart of the gospel.
And while our thanks there go to Anne Farr, Pax Christi Executive Committee Member, we stay with Philippa Hitchin as she speaks to Father Mark Madden, Parish Priest of St Cecilia in Liverpool, in Northern England, whose parish is twinned with Rafidia near Nablus.
So how does this twinning relationship express itself now? It's developed a lot since the early days, hasn't it?
It's developed immensely. When I first came here, the parish experienced severe damp within the church and sacristy, so we helped towards that and repairing the windows and air conditioning and so on. But it's developed into friendships, my friendship with the parishioners, my friendship with the parish priest, but more importantly, friendships between my parishioners and the parishioners here. So there is constant communication between many people. People from Liverpool have now been to Nablus. There are more coming this year. We've had two visits from parishioners from Nablus now, from here to Liverpool. So that increases and strengthens the bonds of friendship. We're now looking towards strengthening ties with my parishes and the high school in Nablus, St Joseph's School, and also to see how my local high schools can get involved in friendship and communicating with pupils in the school in Nablus. So it's developed immensely, and there's still ways, and we're still looking at various ways of how we can strengthen those ties of friendship.
This visit has a particular significance, doesn't it, as you're opening a new centre, a new youth centre here on, beside the church?
Yes. There were no facilities for young people, and we saw that as a need, not just for the young people, not just for the Catholic young people, but for the young people from all the Christian communities in general in Nablus. And there was a derelict building which we thought was ideal, and it's now developed into an incredible building facility for the young Christians of Nablus. And you know, it's been funded by so many major sponsors, the Night of the Holy Sepulchre of England and Wales, and I think this alone will see the benefits coming from this building.
It's particularly important, isn't it? So many of the people here in the West Bank are young kids,
yes.
And with very little future,
yes.
Many of them.
And there's actually not much to do for them, not much support. And so for the church to get involved with this project says a lot about the investing in young people. And as I said, I think we'll see the benefits of this centre for many, many years, you know.
The Catholic Church is one of four Christian communities here in
Yes.
Nablus, isn't it?
Yes, I would say there's around 900 to 1,000, less than 1,000 Christians in Nablus, various Christian communities, Anglican, Orthodox, Melchite and so on. For the Latin parish, there's around 50 to 60 families.
Is that number decreasing? We hear so much about Christians leaving the region.
Since my involvement with the parish, it's more or less been stable. But again, one of the reasons for this youth centre is to try and encourage young people to stay. And again, you know, that's our intention in all that we do, is, and again, with the friendships, to say to the people, you know, we're with you, we'll support you in every way, because it's important that they stay in the whole land. Because, you know, I think the percentage of Christians now is only 2% in the whole of the Holy Land.
This is what you're bringing to them here in Nablus. What do they bring to you there in Liverpool?
They bring immense love and friendship, and they support me, they support the Archbishop, they support all of their friends in Liverpool with prayer, and that's the most important thing. Prayer is needed for everything, and you know, I don't think I can do my job as a priest in Liverpool without their support and their prayers and their love and commitment, and you know, and that's far more important than anything else. And you know, that's a very special gift that they certainly give to me and to my parishioners.
Would you like to see this project expanding, replicated in other areas of Liverpool and other places around the country, indeed?
Very much so. And I think certainly in England, there are many other parishes, many down in the south of England. I think we were the first, and probably, I think, maybe the only one still in the north of England. But certainly in the south, in East Anglia especially, there are many other parishes that are twinned with parishes in the Holy Land. So we're not unique, and we've never claimed to be unique. I think it is important for ourselves at home, who do live comfortable lives, to get involved in many different ways. You know, in England and Wales, an organisation called Friends of the Holy Land was launched by the Patriarch, who came over to Liverpool and Birmingham just over a year ago. If twinning is not possible for parishes, because all parishes in the Holy Land are twinned now, two or three times over, the Friends of the Holy Land is an ideal, perfect way. It's both spiritual and financial support. And as I said, the benefits for us are immense.
And our thanks there go to Father Mark Madden, parish priest of St. Cecilia in Liverpool, and of course to Philippa Hitchin. Finally, time to visit a very special Benedictine, currently based at St. Anselmo here in Rome, as Secretary General to the head of the Benedictine Confederation. He's Dom Henry O'Shea, who was kind enough to share with me some thoughts about the saint, who is and has been of great inspiration to him, and not just to him.
I think the legacy is one which is, first of all, profoundly spiritual, but it's a spirituality that tempers a certain kind of humanity. We speak about Benedictine humanism. I think that's one of the things we need today. First of all, the present Holy Father speaks a lot about faith and reason. I think Saint Benedict manages in his rule to combine both admirably. But I think what is most needed today for most people, a reason for living. And Saint Benedict provides this in his perspective of the constant presence of God, the importance of prayer, the importance of the scriptures, the importance of community, but within that, the huge importance of the individual, of individual responsibility. I think all of these things are extremely relevant today.
Benedict was also proclaimed patron saint of Europe by another pope, Paul VI, in 1964. Do you think this title is still fitting today?
I think very much so. Obviously, Paul VI, who was a great fan of St. Benedict and the Benedictine, had very much in mind the cultural impact of St. Benedict and the Benedictines, and for that reason he chose St. Benedict as the patron, because much of what we regard as European civilization stems from the Benedictine approach. This is shared, of course, by the present Holy Father. I suppose as a Benedictine I have to agree with him on that. But I think that the basic insights of Paul VI are still very, very valid. And for that reason, this choice of patron, I think, should remain. John Paul II, of course, supplemented that. He always spoke about the two lungs of the East and West. And he added St. Cyril and Methodius to a list of patrons. Of course, it's so happy, I suppose we could put it that way, that St. Cyril is supposed to be buried in San Clemente. So we have this wonderful presence here in Rome of both, or in Italy at least, of both lungs.
Monks were the medieval missionaries travelling right across the world, in the sense that they did active work in the world rather than retreat from the world. Is that so still today? Do you think the monk's role, the Benedictine monk's role, has changed over the centuries?
Over the centuries, undoubtedly. I think we tend today to have what is really a rather lately developed perspective of the monk as primarily a contemplative shut-in. That has never really been the case, except for certain reform movements such as the Carthusians, etc. But generally speaking, certainly in the early centuries, monks have always lived in and been part of their society. And of course, as you rightly said, in certain parts of Europe, the monks were actually the missionaries. We think of St. Boniface, for example, in Germany. We've got to be very careful, of course, not to claim that every single monk before the 16th century was a Benedictine, because the concept of a Benedictine order is relatively modern. This does not mean, of course, that there weren't thousands and thousands of monks who followed the rule of St. Benedict. So we've got to be very careful in all our historical judgments that we don't look at things through what is essentially a modern prism. And I think many of the activities that Benedictines were involved in these early centuries, can mutatis mutandis still be very valid today? For example, missionary work, what does that consist today? We talk about, for example, in modern Europe, we talk about a re-evangelization. I think monks have a huge role to play in that by providing in their monasteries centres of, for want of a better word, spirituality, but far more than that, centres of prayer, of thought, of encounter with many of the difficulties faced by our contemporary society. We tried very much in my own monastery, for example, in Ireland, to do that, particularly given the specific difficulties that we're suffering. We're encountering in Ireland at the moment.
Your abbey is Glenstall Abbey in Ireland, is that right?
Ireland, yes, it's the only abbey for men, Benedictine abbey for men in the Republic of Ireland. There's also a smaller house in the north of Ireland of Olivetan Benedictines. But they too are very much engaged in what's most important to the north of Ireland, the work of reconciliation. But we in the south, in the Republic, we try in our monastery to provide a forum, as we did since the 1960s, for ecumenical meeting and encounter, which is very important then, as it is now. But increasingly, the mission in modern Ireland is one of renewal of the church, of renewing the relevance of the church to most Irish people by the examination, for example, of the various problems that these people have, intellectual, spiritual, moral, and of course also economic.
You describe the Benedictines as being inserted, in a sense, in modern society, yet the rule of St. Benedict's drawn up in 527. So you still follow this rule, do you?
Basically, yes. The age of a particular text does not necessarily mean that it automatically falls into desuetude. Think, for example, of the scriptures, or think of some literary texts which are still valid thousands of years after they were written. The rule, I think, is, you could say, the proof of the pudding is in the eating, and the rule has survived all these centuries because, basically, it works. Clearly, there are aspects of the rule which are crazy today. They talk about physical punishment for those who are disobedient, for example. They talk about things like sleeping in your habit and making sure to remove your knife before you do so. Clearly, those are historically conditioned aspects, but there are eternal elements in the rule which I think are still extremely valid.
Would you say that the rule of St. Benedict teaches something that is very balanced? On the one hand, there's the spiritual aspect, on the other, the going out in the world aspect.
It is a bit of a cliche, but nonetheless true for that, the great balance of the rule. And that explains, of course, why of the many monastic rules that were around at the time, it eventually became successful. There are other historical reasons for that too.
Offshoots of the Benedictines?
No. There were, at the time of the writing of the what became the rule of Benedict, there were many other rules, for example, St. Canabas of Ireland, etc. But these rules were in some cases regarded as too crazy or too difficult or too abstruse. The balance of the Benedictine rule was certainly one of the factors that determined its success. I'm not terribly happy with this idea of staying in the monastery and going out into the world. I'm not so sure that those are the alternatives that are present in the rule. Certainly it's true that in the rule, St. Benedict envisages the monk staying for most of his time in the monastery. Though he does make provision for monks to travel, etc., etc. No, I think the more important thing is that the monks are this presence in society. People can come to the monastery and experience what it means to live this balance, this Christian balance of prayer, spirituality, work, and also this valuing of the individual, which I think is very important.
What kind of questions do people who come here seeking spiritual help ask you?
Those vary a lot. Some people come here with their specific requests. For example, teach me to pray. Some people come to talk about personal difficulties. Some cases they want definite spiritual advice. Some cases it's quite clear that they're basically in need of and are seeking what we now would regard as professional help. But for the most part, people who come, particularly those who eventually decide to become oblates of a monastery, that is, lay associates, they want to find some way of structuring what is usually already a Christian life. But they want to find something that will give them a balance, something that will give sense to their working, in inverted commas, in the world. Something that will help them in their family lives, in their professional lives, in their spiritual lives. And they find that the structure that the monastic life offers is both firm enough and at the same time flexible enough to give them that particular structure.
And warm thanks there to Dom Henry O'Shea, currently based at Sant'Anselmo here in Rome as Secretary General to the head of the Benedictine Confederation, Abbot Notker Wolf. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Laudetur Jesus Christus.